Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour,
how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup?
And first, with tensions along the India and China border leaving soldiers killed and emotions high, the risk of war is increasing. What is the cause of these tensions and how can they be de-escalated? Contributing host Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Earlier this month, India reported that 20 members of its armed forces were killed in fighting with Chinese forces along a disputed border in the Himalayas. This is the first reported loss of life since 1975. China has not reported its deaths. On today's show, we examine the background to these tensions and how they complicate this important relationship between the two most populous nations in the world. Two nations that are also armed with nuclear weapons and have rapidly growing economies. Our guest is Ritu Mathur, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas in San Antonio. She is the author of the upcoming book, Civilization Discourses and Weapons Control, which will be available in August of this year. Dr. Mathur, first, what exactly happened on this border? There's not a lot of clarity as to what the events actually were.
Yeah, there is a lot of murkiness with regard to exactly what is happening on the India-China border. And this is a very, very important issue because these are two nuclear-powered states with the largest populations in the world. And so while there are media reports, like from the last 1 week, which we have been following, there were reports that there have been Chinese incursions into Indian territory, that although no firearms were used, but that, you know, batons were used, and that Indian, you know, soldiers' bodies were mutilated. So all these reports were coming out, and there was a lot of, you know, with the social media, there was a lot of sense of hysteria about a war buildup, you know, on both sides of the border. And you could see, you know, photographs, pictures coming out, you know, of Chinese goods being boycotted and effigies of leaders being burned, you know, and also, you know, also in, like 20 soldiers died. And so the bodies of the Indian soldiers being brought home. And so that sense that, you know, that sense of grief along with that sense of nationalism was extremely heightened. And it was, I think, this entire week was very, very, you know, even like I live overseas, but there was a sense of concern about our families, you know, living in India and, you know, those who are living in the border areas about what is going to happen. And also the thing is that because, you know, on the other side, we have Pakistan. So you have nuclear weapon states and then the possibility of a war. And then there's a possibility of a two-front war at a time when you were actually coping with a pandemic. Right. So all of this actually escalated a sense of tension within, you know, the society and in the global sphere. But fortunately, I think the leaders have acted very, very responsibly, both India and China, in making an effort to de-escalate the tensions. And to be honest with you, till today morning, basically, you know, we were just waiting with bated breath. And then Modi came out with the statement at the All India Party meeting saying that basically India's sovereignty will be defended at all costs. But that basically there have been no more border posts in Ladakh were not occupied. And then the opposition party is also saying in a sense that we need to de-escalate some of the jingoistic nationalist rhetoric which is coming out and that, you know, the parties need to work in cooperation with each other. And also on the side of even the Chinese academics who were voicing their concerns were also asking for de-escalation of tensions and saying that both these countries are very responsible countries exercising, you know, maximum restraint for several decades because they are nuclear weapon states, but there really haven't been, you know, border skirmishes in so many decades between India and China. So it has largely been a peaceful border. And so the sudden ignition, in a sense, was obviously a matter of concern. But I think the message which came out from the political leadership on both sides of the border was one of responsibility, one of de-escalation, was one in a sense of basically exercising maximum restraint. And so this again called for confidence building measures and saying, yeah, it is basically an issue of infrastructural development at the borders, which actually escalated these tensions.
We're going to get into the infrastructure development in a moment, but one fascinating aspect of this for me, since you talked about the importance that both sides have placed on ensuring kind of a peaceful coexistence along this border that isn't exactly a border. It's always described as a line of control because it's not decided. But you said it appears as though the fighting that took place was done without firearms. And my understanding is because both sides have agreed not to arm the soldiers along the borders. Could you, along this border in particular, could you speak to that a bit? Is this a sign that whether you arm them or not, they're going to continue to fight? Or is this a sign that that decision not to arm the two sides makes de-escalation easier?
I think the decision, you have to look back in a sense at the colonial legacy which comes with the borders, you know, with these post-colonial countries in a sense. Because the way we understand borders in the Western literature, in a sense, and how we negotiate those borders in the Western literature from the European experience, you know, Eurocentrism in a sense that comes into play, is very different in the Asian context, especially in the areas Asia and Africa, because a lot of these wars, disputes in a sense, come up with the idea of, oh, well, where is the border, mm-hmm. right? Now, India and China have both been ancient civilizations, thousands of years of living in coexistence with next to each other. It was during the colonial era, you know, when the British imperialists were looking for areas of where they could actually have an altitude superiority, right? And that is where they, in a sense, made Tibet the focal point because of the altitude which it provided them. And the Shimla Agreement, in a sense, was signed in 1914 between the British India and the Tibetans, of which China was never a part because China always regarded Tibet as part of its own territory. Mm-hmm. And so this issue, in a sense, basically has been in play. And the idea that this border was never very clearly defined, but at the same time, there has always been a sense of understanding. Now, these are two different civilizations which basically live next to each other. So there are not, you know, it's not a, what would I say, a border with, you know, patrols, you know, armed in that sense, etc. But there was a long-term cultural understanding which came with understanding of, you know, these different societies, different cultures living side by side next to each other. And a culture in which there was a great deal of exchange of ideas, you know, educationists used to travel, there was a trade route which existed, religious exchanges used to take place, etc. And then, yes, we did, you know, when the societies became independent in the 1947 India, 1949 China, there were again efforts made, in a sense, to basically maintain the peace between these two countries. And the, what you call in today, we refer to as line of actual control. Yeah, there are debates with regard to, yeah, there's line of actual control, but where does it really start? Where does it really finish, in a sense? And does China want to maintain the strategic ambiguity so that time and time again, it can basically catch India unguarded? Right. So this has been a matter of concern over a period of time. And so in the 1990s, efforts were made to set up certain confidence building measures between India and China, especially as these countries became even, you know, more militarily invested. And so there was this concern and confidence building measures were undertaken. And in 1996, you know, there was a clear understanding that this area basically will not be, there will no firearms be allowed in this particular area. So in the 1990s, 1993, you had the Border Peace and Tranquility Agreement. And then in 1996, a further reinforcement that no firearms, you know, should be allowed. And I think in a sense that is very, very helpful because looking at the current situation, you know, because we have batons over here which are being used, but, you know, no firing in a sense taking place. So yes, that was very, very important to take into account. And yes, Modi has tried to raise the issue of exchanging maps with regard to the border areas, right, which was an issue which the Congress, or the earlier government of India, was not trying to vocalize very this thing. But the Chinese have basically skirted this issue. So that is an area which leaves a room for strategic ambiguity there.
Generally, the Western press isn't terribly knowledgeable about this border and about these issues. And actually, an event that doesn't get covered nearly as extensively in, say, international relations or international history discourses is the 1962 war between China and India, which seemingly, I mean, my understanding was really about establishing where the border was and trying to establish the line of control. How much does that war highlight, first, the concerns along this border, and then possibly some of the motivation behind some of these confidence building measures?
1962 war is looked at it was a situation of national humiliation for India because we lost that war. So that trauma also, in a sense, because we regarded China as a trusted partner, because especially as both these countries came out of their colonial past, both of them were fighting for their freedom struggle. So there was a great deal of empathy and a great deal of trust. And that is why India actually supported China to become a permanent member on the UN Security Council. And India also, in a sense, basically relinquished its, understanding of Taiwan as a separate country. So India was extremely supportive of China during this period of time in the early 1940s, 1950s in a sense. And so for this war to take place was a total sense of distrust which came about. But at the same time, I would say that, from 1962 to today, it is 2020, and there are huge differences. Because for the last 47 years, there has been no conflict, no large arms-scale conflict. In the 1971, when India was engaged with a war in Bangladesh, again, China had an opportunity, but China was literally weak also, and China did not get involved in that particular conflict. Right. Yes, it is true, basically, because China's relations starting with Russia and India and Russia getting closer, China, became more helpful with Pakistan during that period of time. So, yes, there was shifting in terms of the alliances which were taking place during this period of time. If you look at it, 1962, we had the war, right? But there was a sense of trauma and a suffering with it. 1970s, India moved closer to Russia. China moved closer towards Pakistan. Late 1980s, 1990s, both were in a sense trying to engage with economic practices. So while China was getting closer to the US, with Kissinger's visit in a sense, India in the 1990s with its own economic liberalization, both the countries became more and more focused on economic development. So that became a priority for both these countries, and the border issues, in a sense, the military issues, those became more secondary in nature.
So there's still rivalry between the two countries, but the rivalry tends to be expressed more in political terms than necessarily military terms. Because one thing that comes to mind to me has been India's pretty consistent, for example, for the Dalai Lama in Tibet. It's been largely political support, but a bit of a political, say, thumb in the eye to the, to the Chinese. But also India's assertion that this is based on political principle. Tibet was invaded in 1959 and has these expressions of independence. So how much do you see, say, India's support of Tibet? Is this part of the ongoing rivalry with China? Is it based more on principle, or what's behind that motivation?
There are two considerations at play over here. One of it is that India is a democracy and India does support religious freedom. And so it is in that respect that the Dalai Lama's freedom, of expression, freedom of movement, and the practice of Buddhism, in a sense, is acknowledged and respected within India, right? So that is one point with it. The other thing is that the location, as I mentioned earlier, in between India and China relations, in terms of strategically, what really matters is also the altitude. So having Tibet as a buffer state between India and China, Tibet also, in a sense, the location, even the Galwan Valley conflict, basically, if you look at it, it was a question of the altitude. Right, because both these countries are building their border infrastructure in those areas. It's a question of who gets a tactical advantage with regard to the altitude within that particular terrain.
When I first heard of this case in 2020, what immediately came to mind to me was the 2017 border dispute over the Doklam region. It was not just India and China, it also involved a third party. But in essence, the two sides sort of flexing their muscles along the border, but then deciding to de-escalate because there were larger issues involved. In light of some much larger strategic interests, how much does the 2017 case offer some insights into what might happen in 2020, and what's your understanding of what happened specifically in that 2017 case?
If you go back, when you look at, what have been the skirmishes between India and China, right? So there have been 2013, 2014, and then 2017, the Doklam, became a major, escalation point again. But again, you see, both the countries came together, tried to diffuse the spirit. So you had the meeting which took place, what is referred to as a Wuhan spirit, in a sense of, again, of reconciliation, in a sense of talking about peace, talking about economic development, etc. So from time and time, you have these skirmishes skirmishes which are taking place. But then again, you see both these countries, in a sense, trying to de-escalate, trying to, in a sense, come to some kind of a bilateral understanding, you know, of these particular issues. And also, I think we have to pay attention to, in a sense, of how China, you know, in a sense, looks at itself. It looks at itself as the big hegemonic power in East Asia now. And also, in a sense, the U.S. is a big actor, you know, as a lone superpower, you know, interested in maintaining its power projection capabilities in that particular area. This triangle which is building up between U.S., India, and China also has to be taken into consideration, because you cannot understand this conflict, this skirmish in May without understanding, again, that this started actually in April again with Dalai Lama wanting to, you know, visit the Tathagata monastery, basically. So this again, the issue of Dalai Lama, the Tibet coming into play, China's sensitivities with regard to U.S. encirclement and using India as an ally, as a pawn within this, in a sense. So how far has India made an effort to reassure China, right, about what are its concerns with regard to this? And at the same time, how much effort is China building, in a sense, to build more confidence among its neighbors? Because there is a fear with regard to Chinese aggression, with the size of the China's economy, the China's military strength. And so, you know, some of this global discourse which comes out into play, like, you know, for example, during the Cold War period, you had the ideological conflict in the US, in a sense, talking about Russia as the menace, you know, in some terms of communism, etc. And then with the collapse of the former USSR, that filling of that gap, you know, who's the next enemy, in a sense, who's next? And then China being put into that picture. So that sensitivity which has been there over a period of time. And so again, these polarizing discourses which come into play, you know, the Cold War, East versus the West, then in the 1990s, West versus the rest, you know, Huntington's civilizational clash with China, again, the next contender in a sense. Then 9/11, war on terror, in a sense, you know, again, this concern about, you know, the Muslim population, etc. And then, you know, this constant rhetoric, in a sense, which keeps building up the sense of enmity within the cyclical patterns which keep coming into play. So these become, in a sense, overwhelming at times. And so that is where, in a sense, we have to look at the security archive. And in a sense, we have to look at the paucity and the pathos of the security archive, which only makes us look and think in these particular ways of, you know, who's the enemy and who's the friend. And so this polarizations, right, whether they are ideological, whether they are in terms of, you know, democracy versus authoritarian states, etc. And then what kind of solutions do we come up with? You know, also, in a sense, is it always a case of, oh, regime change? Is that the solution for every problem that we have? Because how can you bring about a regime change in nuclear weapon states? It's extremely difficult. So those who are saying that, oh, you know, this is China's authoritarian regime is a problem. So in a sense, yeah, but the fact of the matter is that you have lived with this regime right mm-hmm. next to you in India for decades. And China has been a player in the global organizations, you know, whether they're economic, whether they are political. It has been a member of the UN Security Council over a period of time. So what are the relationships which have developed over this period of time, right? Mm-hmm. How has China also been socialized into these so-called, you know, liberal, global liberal norms, in a sense? We have to pay attention to those practices also.
From a geostrategic perspective, American power and the power, say, of the G7, economically, politically, has been largely unchecked until relatively recently, where it appears there's this possibility, and there's been some literature on the way in which the global South, as expressed through the BRICS Forum, the BRICS standing for Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, that this can serve as a potential check on American power. And although all five countries are important, the two largest of those economies are certainly India and China. And I think it's fair to say that that relationship is essential if we're going to speak of the BRICS as any sort of a coalition, that whether it's an anti-American coalition or at least a check on American power, or a check on G7 power, or whatever. And what was striking to me about the 2017, the Doklam case, was it appears as though India had asserted, in essence, to China that if you want to continue this cooperation, you're going to need to de-escalate. Because it did appear as though it was a Chinese road that triggered that escalation. And so this is something we've seen Indian-Chinese relations. The two countries saying, in essence, we have to get along. We have to promote economic cooperation, political cooperation, because the one country that benefits the most if there's a division between the two is the United States. How salient is that as an argument, and how effective, how appealing is that, you know, as an argument, in particular in India?
I think it is a very, pertinent observation, you know, when they talk about how the imperialist powers are once again trying to drive a wedge between the developing countries, you know, so this neo-colonial practices, in a sense, which have been put into place. So, for example, China, you know, they issued a statement saying that the U.S. is basically following a colonial policy towards Asian giants of divide and rule. And so this argument that, you know, so suddenly in the 1990s, that U.S. suddenly woke up to the fact that India is a democracy, right? And therefore, there should be an alliance of democracies coming into play, right? Mm-hmm. So this argument, which is there in a sense, and so it is important also to think in terms of, you know, where is the rhetoric and where is the money? What is really happening over here? Because on the one hand, you have the rhetoric of U.S., India being like-minded democracies, and that their interest is in human rights promotion and free press, etc. And therefore, we have to form an alliance. But at the same time, if you look at it, you know, we have this Indo-Pacific, you know, area, which is very of key importance to both U.S. and India in a sense. But even though the alignments, which are the Quad, which was established, but there really hasn't been any momentum. So when we talk about U.S. leadership, right, the rhetoric is there, but in terms of actually developing those areas strategically, that has really not been the case. Right. So today, India, even in terms of this particular conflict, India really looks around. God forbid if there is an escalation of this particular issue, of this particular conflict, will U.S. come to the aid of India? It looks very unlikely because this is an election year in the U.S. Right. And Trump is basically not interested in any conflict, escalation, etc. And White House statements which came out, right, with regard to this, that we're not even interested in mediation. All the provocative statements came out from congressmen, in a sense, saying, oh, the death of 20 Indian soldiers will never be forgotten, etc. So, yeah, all the rhetoric of empathy is definitely over there. But at the same time, in a sense, has U.S. made a further effort in terms of strengthening its bonds with India with regard to the Quad, with regard, you know, even with the BRICS also, in terms of like China, on the other hand, because see, for the developing countries from the beginning of the Cold War period, the unity between the developing countries was built on the memory and the legacy of the imperialist powers and colonialism. This was the bond of unity. This was the bond of, you know, collective self-determination among these people, in a sense. And that legacy of colonialism, that legacy of imperialism, that legacy of racialism has not been forgotten. Today also you have race riots in the US, and that makes people in the other parts of the world really sit up. So while we talk about like-minded countries, we talk about democracies, we also have to understand the nature and character of these democracies. You have billion population in India, which is extremely religiously, culturally very, very diverse, more than 2,500 languages spoken in India itself. So unless and until U.S. in a sense comes across as a very sincere actor, which is basically not only just talking in terms of democracy or regime change, but actually talks about socioeconomic reforms. And this, when we're talking about human rights, we're always talking about civil and political liberties, which are definitely very important. There should be no compromise with regard to civil and political liberties. But at the same time, the vast majority of the population in these countries is living in great poverty. And so both for India and China, the economic agenda is extremely important. And even in the economic agenda, how is this being implemented? Has there been any reforms with regard to the World Bank or the IMF? Has there been any reforms with regard to the UN, UN Security Council, etc.? It is a very sad because, you know, while India supported China on the UN Security Council, the Chinese today did not even offer a well-acknowledged note to India, which has won with 184 votes of membership on the UN Security Council as a non-permanent member. So this is very, very important, because if the US is interested in this, this kind of engagement, these are the issues which we really need to talk about. Because if you don't, then China is building parallel institutions where you have IMF and World Bank controlled by the Western powers. China is coming up with the new Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you know, the Belt and Road Initiative, etc. Yes, there is a certain degree of angst with regard to China because of the secrecy, with regard to the debt burden of these countries, etc. But there is also, you know, that incentive that at least we are developing some, you know, infrastructure, we're providing employment. Whereas here, from the Western world, in a sense, what are the people in the developing countries actually getting from it, apart from, you know, backslapping on being democracies? Because that does not really fill the, you know, the stomach of the people who are hungry. Mm-hmm. And with unemployment rising steadily, both in India and both in China, this is a major concern. And especially when at a time of pandemic, you know, where people's economic livelihood has actually been suffered grievously, in a sense. And so that is a time of acute awareness that we actually raise these concerns and, you know, take them up with a great deal more sincerity.
The picture you paint, the picture that we see here, are two countries that, though their economies are growing, certainly the pandemic has offered some significant economic concerns. And you suggested, and I'll make explicit, the two countries are growing, but they still have deep divides. They still have deep poverty in certain areas of those countries and the need for both further development and resources to be applied in those areas. Plus, there's the geostrategic interest that if, I think part of what you were suggesting here is there have been some authors who have suggested that the U.S. can drive this wedge between India and China, but you're skeptical at the American commitment to India and that and the suspicion that Indians, that the Indian government, though they're welcoming of whatever, you know, of some American consideration, that that's probably not something that the Indian leaders can rely on. So all this paints a picture. But the one thing that I think both sides, India and China, and I think the two of us agree, would be disastrous, would be an escalation of this conflict. But there's one actor out there that's complicating things. And those are the actors on social media. And, you know, the reports coming out of certain like news shows or talk shows. What's the possibility that the emotional tensions coming out of social media and some of the discourses, and we know much more about India because India is a more open society, certainly, than China, that they might drive Indian leaders into positions that really are not strategically tenable?
Yeah, that is a serious concern right now, you know, with the cyber warfare becoming a serious matter of concern in a sense. So these issues, in a sense, which came up with, you know, why did Modi have to have a virtual meeting with the Prime Minister of Australia and the Australian Prime Minister saying, oh, we have had a cyber attack, they're not attributing the blame directly to who the actor is. And so these stories and then reports and counter reports, which are coming about the number of casualties and, you know, incursions, etc. So in this climate, like in the 1962 war, you basically had state-controlled media in both the countries. Mm-hmm. So it was much more easy to regulate the information. Whereas from 1962, this is now 2020, where you have multiple sources of information coming into play. So how are you going to regulate? How are you going to channelize that information? How are you going to provide credible information? That is a serious concern. And that is why where India and China both actually are developing these technologies, you know, the Indian IT sector and the Chinese IT sector are both extremely strong. But what is a problem in terms of what is happening over here, as I told you, is also the economic competition between these two countries. Because China started, you know, in 1979 onwards, you can say China started on this path of, you know, neoliberal economic reforms. So China has focused for two decades prior to India on export promotion. And so China's basically manufacturing capacity is multitudinously more than that of India's. India started its economic liberalization in the 1990s, late 1990s. So today when India looks at China's manufacturing capacity, when India looks in terms of China's supply chains, India also feels that it is lagging behind. And with growing unemployment rates, and because also while the economic, you know, exchanges between these two actors have grown, there's also a trade deficit between India and China. So how do you control that trade deficit? Because, you know, what is happening also again with the rhetoric coming out of the US of trade wars between US and China and tariff wars coming up between US and China, etc. These similar arguments, in a sense, are played out in the Indian context saying, oh, we also have a trade deficit. Yes, we also basically are finding that we are importing more, that our manufacturing is getting wiped out. So analogies are being drawn between, you know, US and China, I mean, and India and China. But we also have to understand some of the, you know, the context between these, you know, different countries in a sense, because India's infrastructure in India's, you know, supply chains, India's labor market is very, very different from the Chinese labor market. So unless and until there's a larger understanding of these issues, you know, we have to be very, very concerned. And another thing is that in the midst of this pandemic, the Indian government basically said that it's going to open, you know, its defense sector to 74% foreign direct investment from overseas. And it said that this is not privatization, this is corporatization. And that whatever is going to be produced is going to help Indian military forces absorb it so that there is no increment in the, you know, import, India's military import bills, right? Because both India and China are heavily into military modernization with large, you know, budgets in this particular context. But anybody having a closer reading of this and will actually argue, if India claims it is a democracy, then how is such a powerful legislation with regard to opening the defense sector be passed without even a rigorous debate within the country, etc. So this again raises a concern, like what surplus capacity you're going to produce? Will that be a case of becoming an arms exporter? In the US, you know, this logic which comes about, you know, resetting the foreign relations with every new administration which comes, whether it's the Democrats, then you have a different set of relations. When you have Republicans, it's a different set of relations. The US is a rich country. Perhaps it can afford to reset these relations from time to time. But India does not have that economic or military clout to do the reset button time and time again. And so for the Modi administration to deny the legacy of, you know, non-aligned movement or the Look East policy to some extent, you know, has been a very hard lesson. And that is why Modi, who had ignored, you know, the NAM summits for a period of time, basically had attended the NAM summit in this year, in 2020, May 2020, I think, right? And so for them to understand that we cannot, yes, we are democracies, but we are not a democracy like America. We are not as militarily and economic powerful in that sense. So the question is not one of imitation, but one of creativity and in one of building on the legacies which we have actually put into place, where the policy of equidistancing between the powerful countries is extremely important. And so when Modi goes to hug Trump in a sense, right, that images, right, those also sent alarm to the neighboring countries. And so India has to focus also in terms of developing its relationships with its neighboring countries, you know, in a sense, and basically not totally disowning its legacy, but embracing that legacy which actually it has into place because it has served its interests in the long run.
So considering the potential impact of this conflict, the geostrategic interest in de-escalation, and what's exactly at stake, I think we're both guardedly optimistic that at least this specific skirmish is going to de-escalate. But I suspect this won't be the last time we're talking about border issues between India and China and the strategic rivalry, potential rivalry between the two states.
I can only hope that there is space, especially in these times when both the countries need to invest more in their education and in their health, that, you know, the military expenditures actually will decline. That will also help and reduce tensions in this particular area. So yes, global ambitions are there, you know, being great power status ambitions are there, but you actually, the vast majority of the population in both countries need, you know, focusing more in terms of education and health. And actually border security is important and building of that infrastructure is necessary. But at the same time, you know, it is much more important to focus on confidence building measures. And, you know, the era of quiet diplomacy is not over and it has a role to play. So if there has to be a reset of, you know, button or relationships, I think it should be in the direction of more peace and economic prosperity. Thank you very much.
Very well said. Thank you very much. I'll give you the last word. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
You've listened to a conversation about the border skirmishes between India and China and the strategic interests of India. Our guest was Ritu Mathur, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Geography at the University of Texas, San Antonio. She's the author of an upcoming book, Civilization Discourses and Weapons Control, which will be available in August. This is Scholar Circle. scholarcircle.org.
When we come back, how does privatization amount to a constitutional coup? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Privatization of government services has been in place since Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, both who roundly attacked government and civil servants as the enemy. Now, however, the government has become in the service of those who once opposed it. The process has been part of what John Michaels calls a constitutional coup. John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic. Now, you have recently published a book, Constitutional Coup. Coup's a pretty powerful word.
It is. And in fairness, the title was conceived well before the election of Donald Trump, when I would have put much money on Secretary of State Hillary Clinton winning the presidency. Now, obviously, I had time to incorporate what it means for Donald Trump to be the president. But the book is really about the way in which the commercialization of government, the outsourcing of key functions, privatization, all of those features of kind of modern neoliberal government, what you call running government like a business or whatever the kind of tropes are of the moment. It's been bipartisan, again, since the 80s, essentially undermines essential rule of law values. It undercuts our separation of powers, and it becomes a tool of heightened executive power. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, I was concerned about that. I started these projects not only saying, you know, thinking Hillary Clinton was going to win. I started writing these projects in the late 2000s when Barack Obama, president, I have great admiration and was happy to have President Obama lead the country. I was still concerned about these trends. These are trends that are partisan. Bill Clinton was a mover in running government like a business. And so the concerns there are really about essentially how commercialization of government isn't just about fraud and abuse of the kind of fiscal sort, which is largely what we've talked about over the years, whether it's military contracting or prison contracting, but it actually undermines central safeguards of our constitutional republic. And that's why I call it a coup, because it completely transforms the way we do everything from welfare services to environmental law to fighting wars to criminal justice. And of course, this has taken on kind of almost cartoonish characteristics in the Trump era, where it seems like, you know, there's very little distance, as it were, between Trump organization, the business operation, and Trump presidency, whether it's, you know, the various Ivanka endeavors or Kushner's real estate deals or Trump talking about, you know, his winery when questions were asked about the kind of KKK rallies in Charlottesville, and his response was, I have, you know, vineyards there. So this has taken on almost cartoonish perspective. And even in the book, I have kind of an optimistic line, which is when we kind of see our way out of the current moment, it might be an opportunity. There might be kind of a bureaucratic renaissance where we realize that some of the folks who kept this country going were the bureaucrats, and we start investing more heavily in a professional civil service. I'm not sure when we get to that point, but that's, again, the kind of ultimate goal, because the civil service provides a very meaningful and powerful check on political agency heads that often represent 48% of the country.
But that's when people are interested in the truth. So, like, when
yes.
So that's a clear distinction between what we have now and what we may have had under previous presidents. I mean, to some degree. I recognize
right.
that there's degrees to all of this, that it's not black and white.
That is true. But my theory on why we need to have what I call in the book administrative separation of powers is because the concerns that I'm raising under Donald Trump's watch or under George W. Bush's watch are just as important under a Barack Obama's watch. Because if you're really worried that a president who wins with a good win these days is 49-50% of the population, because we're so divided, and if some third candidate runs, that's why no one can get to 50. And all of a sudden, the levers of government shift from the right to the left, and all of a sudden our regulatory policy kind of flips on its head. That's disruptive to everyone. We don't have a parliamentary system where you get, okay, the conservative government's out, the Tory government's out, and now we're going to have a Labour government. Everything's going to change on a dime. We don't have that. For one, it's not our culture. You know, it's not just, forget about our constitution. It's just not our culture to be like that. But secondly, we don't have a fail-safe for that. Because if a Labour government takes the country too far, the government collapses. We have to wait. Yeah. We have to wait sometimes 4 really long, hard years for another crack to change the president and therefore to change the direction of ICE or the direction of the Pentagon or anything else. And so my position really, I think, is a position that should appeal to those who believe that the center matters and the center holds. Even though I'm not a centrist politically, I think the center is key to our political culture and to our legal culture.
So let's shift just a bit into the argument that you're making about privatization harming the Constitution, the country. Now, it's clear that once you privatize something, that the democratic control is gone because it's not transparent in the same way that government is supposed to be transparent. People don't really have a say over a private corporation in the way that they do over government that they collectively own. But what about this rule of law argument that you made just now? How does it undermine rule of law?
So privatization is a complicated issue. So one of the concerns principally about privatization is the government turns over some responsibility to the contractors and the contractors just run with it. And that is a concern about abdication of government power. That is central and that's well known. I'm also concerned about a second type of, let's say, reconfiguration of government power, and this is where the rule of law comes into play as well. A lot of times, the political leadership of the agencies doesn't like the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is slow. The bureaucracy is obstinate. The bureaucracy is going to say, well, that doesn't really, I understand that's what the president campaigned on, but it's not really comports with the statutes that empower us. It's not consistent with our appropriations. It's not consistent with our best scientific understanding. And there's a lot of frustration, a lot of stickiness. And I celebrate that friction because the friction between the political leadership of agencies and the civil servants in some ways reproduces the friction that we hope to exist between Congress and the president. A lot of friction is at the center of our sense of liberty, our sense of pluralism, because it allows more voices to have a say. It does slow things down. It's maddeningly frustrating. But in the 20th century, legislation, so Congress has taken a backseat to agencies. Rules promulgated by agencies become much more central. Think about the environment. We're working off of statutes that are old. The Food and Drug Administration, we're working off statutes that were progressive era statutes. Ever since then, Congress has kind of taken a backseat and the agencies run with it. So if you now have a political leadership that wants to push, let's say, an FDA agenda in a certain direction, let's say, to make it really hard to get over-the-counter or even prescription birth control, as we've seen in various fights, it makes it really hard to do that. That doesn't necessarily match with the best science. You want the pushback. You want the friction. And the civil servants say, no, boss, I can't do that. That's not consistent with our statutory responsibilities to work through the best kind of scientific evidence, and it's not going to be reasonable, and the courts are going to reject it. And so this goes on. Every president doesn't like the civil service. Obama, Clinton, Truman, Eisenhower, whomever. And privatization has now become a backdoor way to get around the civil servants because the contractors are yes men and women, because the civil servants are tenured. You can say no to your boss and show up the next day and get your paycheck. A contractor who says no to the political leadership too much is going to wind up having his contract canceled. So they're going to be completely compliant. And I say the concern isn't runaway contractors as much as it's super compliant contractors, because we lose that friction, that tension that really is at the core of our constitutional regime. So that's why I think it's a basic rule of law question. Once Congress has given the power to the agencies themselves have to be subject to checks and balances. And those checks and balances, as best conceived, is understood between independent civil servants who are professional scientists, economists, social workers, and the politicos who run the agency. And you want both. You want the political and you want the depth that we talked about before. And you want them to have to kind of work out their compromises in the same way that you hope, and that happened in previous eras, that Congress and the president work out their differences.
In an online conversation, you referred to privatization as a weapon of the bullies.
Okay.
Who are the bullies?
The agency heads.
Okay, so the appointees.
I'm not exactly sure what the context was for that.
Key weapon of the bullies.
So it's those who want to essentially enact their policies without following the procedural and substantive hurdles that our Congress and the courts have put into place to make sure that government remains limited and non-arbitrary. It's a shortcut. It's a way to essentially push out civil servants or to scare them. Because once privatization is pervasive as it is now, you don't actually have to use it anymore. The weapon exists because if you're a group of civil servants who like your jobs, now you can't get fired because of your job, but your job could disappear if they find contractors to do it in your place. So if I'm a civil servant sitting at my desk, am I going to push back in a world in which privatization is so rampant and non-controversial? Or am I going to essentially be that the same compliant actor because I don't want to draw the wrath of a political agency head who is very comfortable and very skilled at privatizing? So I think that's what I meant in that context.
So it's a bit of a chilling effect.
Really. Oh, I think it's a quite profound chilling effect. In my book, I refer to Potemkin civil servants who are basically, it says, hey, look, we have this type of meaningful friction between agency heads and civil servants because on paper, they're still classified as civil servants. And on paper, they still have, you know, plenty of legal responsibility. But they look around them and everyone else has been out, all their friends' jobs have been outsourced. They're not going to actually play that role of a fierce civil servant. And it's gotten even worse today. So even outside of the privatization, all this rhetoric that they're, you know, they're disloyal, they're deep staters, whatever you want to say about them. Secretary Zinke gave a speech to a business community basically saying that a third of his agency, the Department of Interior, is disloyal to the flag. So there's all sorts of like whistleblowing with the flag saluting. There's all that, not whistleblowing, dog whistling about flags and disloyalty about that. But we haven't seen rhetoric like that since McCarthy. And so again, if you're a civil servant today, your morale is probably in the gutter. And it's hard, you know, you say, well, why don't they all quit? A lot of them, you know, they're 55 and they have kids in college and they want their pension. You know, it's hard. But we also see people leaving in unprecedented numbers. The State Department, you know, and it's places where people have the most marketable skills elsewhere. You'll see that they'll leave first, of course. So to me, it's a problem, and it's getting worse, at least in the short term.
You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking with UCLA law professor John Michaels about the future of the Supreme Court, given Donald Trump's new appointment. You mentioned earlier Reagan, and I know in your book you also talked about Margaret Thatcher and the phrase she used of nanny state.
Yeah.
And how there was this push to maybe reduce government or make an enemy of government, calling it the nanny state, but then a move to then put it in the service of something. What is that?
So Reagan ran for office essentially saying he was going to, you know, cut Washington down to size, and he was going to strip the EPA of its resources and the Department of Education and all these kind of grand ways of basically making government super duper small. Then he gets to Washington, and all these people who said, yeah, yeah, great idea, they all kind of wanted to protect their little basically pots of services. And so they got a lot of pushback. And Reagan wasn't able to cut the EPA. In fact, spending rose under his administration. Certainly military spending rose, but even domestic spending rose, and employment rose. But he wanted to cut taxes. He did cut taxes. So we have this escalating deficit. Military spending is through the roof. He can't control domestic spending. So folks at various kind of conservative think tanks said, hey, why don't you try this other idea? It's not exactly what they're doing in the United Kingdom. Because in the United Kingdom, the government-owned state enterprises. They owned Jaguar. They owned, you know, British Petroleum. Those were all state-owned enterprises. We didn't have that. So when they talk about privatization there or privatization in Latin America, it's selling off the telecom companies. We don't have that here Those were always in private hands. When we privatized here, they said, okay, we're going to cut out civil servants and we're going to hire contractors who are cheaper, don't have benefits, essentially the same casualization of labor we see throughout the economy. At that point, it was largely a, you know, it was an ideological tool, but it wasn't with a particular political move to change the substance of government. It was a kind of a cost-cutting measure. And then the Clintons basically, the Clinton-Gore team ran with it. And what I say in the book, in some ways, you know, Reagan is often seen as the kind of critical figure, but in some ways the most important figure is Clinton, because Clinton takes the idea that was it seemed to be a hard right, ideological, anti-government perspective by Ronald Reagan and mainstreams it and defangs it. So it's no longer this, you know, hostile to Washington. This is all now smarter government, technocratic government. And basically makes it seem palatable to bipartisan audiences. Then they realize this bureaucracy is really stubborn. And we see more as contracting becomes more and more pushed upwards. So it's no longer low-level jobs, no longer functionary jobs. But now policymakers are being contracted out. This is great because they can kind of match. We can have them follow our orders in a much more, expeditious fashion than civil servants who might say, I see what you're saying there, but that doesn't, you know, again, I'm just going to say the same thing, but maybe it doesn't support what the law requires. Maybe it's not consistent with best scientific evidence. Maybe it's cutting some procedural corners because civil servants don't work on political timetables. They're not, and they shouldn't be thinking about midterm elections. And so they could say, this is actually going to take 2.5 years to be done. And then the politicos say, I know, but we have to run for re-election in 6 months. And that's where these conflicts are produced. And then in the 2000s, it just takes off. And so the debasement and the marginalization of the civil service, again, cuts out this important legal and political players in our national landscape. And again, you say, civil servants, bureaucrats, I don't see they're mentioned in the Constitution. And I get that. But in the 20th century, we have vast delegations of legislative power, which is supposed to be, if you look at the Constitution, done by the legislature. And now all these responsibilities are being delegated to agencies. Agencies become the critical kind of locus of policymaking, not just at the federal level, but you see the same thing at state level, you see the same thing in any large municipality. Agencies are the main kind of drivers of public policy today. And so we need to think about that space much more carefully than I think we have in the past. And in doing so, it's important to recognize and kind of and credit the role played by the civil servants, that they're not marginal players, they're not illegitimate players. They're meaningful players that have a role, not the dominant role, but a role in the process. And that's why I think if we're going to extend the rule of law to administrative agencies, then we also have to think about what role the civil servants play. And it's much, much bigger than you would understand from reading the Constitution, which doesn't adequately reflect all the dynamics of our current legal and political republic.
So from nanny state to sort of nanny corporation.
Yeah.
So you didn't really talk about the corporate side of this so much just now. How would you incorporate that now for us to understand that?
So my book is much more about the kind of Republican values and smaller Republican values.
Meaning
commitments to rule of law, commitments to checks and balances.
Like the Republic.
The Republic. And republicanism is different from kind of direct democracy. Our country has democracy, but it's leavened by some counter-majoritarian checks. Of course, being one of the critical ones, being a less than, you know, fully responsive Senate because it only gets elected every 6 years is another one. And to me, the civil service is right up there with it. So the book really is a constitutional argument and it's a constitutional cultural argument as well. There's a whole other side, which is the kind of corporate kind of coziness and rent seeking and extravagant profits that are essentially secured because there's a lot of money that the federal government has. And when we're in Iraq and Afghanistan and they're throwing the money out, you could be sure that some of the contractors are putting some of it in their back pockets. The reason why the book doesn't focus on that in part is because I think journalists have done such an effective job of detailing it. Now, whether it's moved public policy is a separate question. But to me, that angle of privatization is well documented and well rehearsed. If you watch things like 60 Minutes or you read the New York Times, you have a decent sense that contractors can be really corrupt. What I wanted to do is talk about, hey, even if this corruption were put under wraps, even if we could control the corruption, there's a different problem, and arguably for my purposes as a constitutional lawyer, a much bigger problem, which is this undermines our rule of law. So the corporate part is incredibly important, but it's in part it's a story that has been told, and more importantly, it can be a distraction. If all we think about the contractors is being greedy, we forget about how actually compliant they are in order to be so greedy. The best way to be a good contractor is to say yes all the time, so you get more and more contracts. That's the best route to being profitable.
So the other thing that you suggested was that in the Trump era, there may be finally a pushback because he and his team have been so brazen. So what do you think might happen?
Well, so that's the big question. What would happen, and just as importantly, I think, is when, for those with some impatience about, you know, what's going to happen next, and I share that. The question is essentially what happens, how does the country come back together, and what is the agenda going forward? And I think if we get to that point and there's some kind of catharsis, some kind of, I don't know if it's truth and reconciliation or whether there's prosecutions, or we just move on and just kind of forget about it. What is the process in which we kind of shore up the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities that have been exposed? Again, I think the country's strong. I think we've done in large part a really good job of keeping ourselves together as a nation with an old and very flawed document as our backbone. But there certainly needs to be much more extensive disclosure requirements for financial holdings, much deeper and easier to enforce conflicts of interest laws. And again, I think we need to do much more to shore up to secure a viable, attractive civil service that will get people to go into this job, which is going to be a hard task itself. You know, why would anyone want to go into the civil service today? I get that from my students all the time. Those are hard questions. They're going to take decades probably to fully kind of right this ship, as it were. Again, that wasn't necessarily what happened after Nixon because everyone closed ranks and we got reforms right afterwards.
Well, we had a divided government too.
We had a
media that was not divided, and we had a government that was.
We had a government that was, and we had a Democratic landslide, which helped. But Republicans, I think, were also chagrined at that point. And so they did their job too. I mean, there were certain things that were, you know, we had congressional overrides of presidential vetoes, which meant you had to have Republican support. We don't get that anymore. So there has to be a political cultural change, a political cultural awakening or recognition before we can get any type of meaningful policy change, because we're going to need to do so through legislation or regulation.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. It's just been a wonderful conversation. Thank you. John Michaels is a professor of law and the author of Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholars Circle team includes Doug Becker and Lillian Ng, contributing hosts, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.